a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Mute, press pound six. And with that, I'll turn it over to the Lieutenant Governor.
Thank you so much, and thank you to all of you who have called in and are present here. We are, as I refer to it, about a fourth of the way through most of the action, so I always call it the first quarter of the football game in the legislative session. It's picking up a good head of steam, I think, for you who are keeping track of it. Obviously, we have all our bills in, and you do the numbers. And actually, some of the Senate committees that I'm most familiar with are even taking some of the House bills. So I'm personally happy about that. I'd like to open up, though, and as you noted, we're noted in our press conference alert, the governor, along with Secretary Lynch, the Secretary of Agriculture, along with Nathan Sanderson, who is one of our agricultural experts, policy analysts here in the governor's office, are in Tulare, California at the World Ag Expo. The World Ag Expo is actually larger than what the phrase describes. There are people predominantly there that are in agribusiness, but also looking for potentials and expansion, both by product and actually by location. The governor has gone to this in the past in the attempt successfully to recruit dairy into our state. We currently have a number of dairy processing plants that I think most people, if you haven't paid attention, it's really growing and is significant, especially in the northeastern and the eastern part of our state. One of the major problems we have, though, is those processors, whether they're making various kinds of cheese or Bell Brands or Davisco, AgroPure, Associated Milk Producers, Valley Queen, all of these producers, we are, through our dairy process and the suppliers, only able to obtain 35% of their capacity right now. So they're getting milk from other states and other providers, and that we have the capabilities of allowing for that. And that is an incredibly important statistic, as you can imagine, in agribusiness, candidly any business, that there is that kind of opportunity to come in and immediately have purchasers of high-quality milk for those processes. So they're meeting. The governor, and it would be my bet that rarely do governors go to these events. And he's been interviewed out there in the past on how significant it is. Governor, as many of you know, come from an agricultural background, has milked in the past. And so he really understands it, very articulate, and from his personal world has been successful in recruiting some dairies. One of the most interesting things that they're going to talk about is the process that the Department of Agriculture has done in what's called the County Site Analysis Program. The County Site Analysis Program is really a land planning tool that the counties can avail themselves of through the Department of Agriculture. In a nutshell, how it works is a county requests assistance, and then there's a survey done of the land and what land has an aquifer below it, what land does not, what land has access points to not only raw product but the roads, etc., and what land then from a setback perspective for zoning would work, and create that kind of inventory. And so actually, it's no different than any other sort of land use program, except it's specifically tailored to dairy. And having an inventory then of potential capacity and sites is extremely important. And this has been a very successful program to identify potential sites, because obviously that is something that the dairy business would want to know. We currently have permitted capacity of about 15,000 more head, and that whole process leads to South Dakota wanting to be, and I think is being recognized as, a leader in this area, especially given the cheese plant capability in that region. And so we will get a report back, obviously, from the governor out there. He's interviewed by the groups out there, and then tomorrow, if not later today, we'll be going to a dairy and doing a tour, I think, near Fresno. So with that, I wanted to let you know what he is up to, and they're usually very successful trips, and I'm sure he'll report back when he gets there. And truly, I think everybody who knows him, especially in the room and on the call, his affability and his comfort zone, he is really selling South Dakota. And so that's where he connects, and he just stands right by the booths, talks to people, goes out, and encourages that it come out. And like I said, the last visit, we had successes as well. Change the topic, and then we'll open it up for question. Just a little bit ago, we were informed that the Department of Legislative Audit released their independent audit of the Governor's Office of Economic Development. That is to the legislature. The Department of Legislative Audit is a department of the essentially independent, but reports directly to the legislature, not the executive branch. You've also received a release from our office here just a little bit ago regarding the results of that independent audit. It was obviously conducted by that independent organization, and we are very pleased that the audit doesn't indicate any wrongdoing beyond what the Attorney General had reported. And we are looking forward to having the legislature engage in the government audit and operations process. As a matter of fact, in the legislature, when I was speaker, way before that, the governor and I knew each other as legislators. We were involved in various aspects of that committee in allowing it to be a very significant body committee to review audits. It's what it does normally. It also has another job, and that is overseeing juvenile corrections. And we believe that that is something that's an absolute to accomplish. And I know that you're in conversations with legislative leadership. You know they're setting up those meetings. So overall, that along with the other three independent audits, nothing surprising, but we very much welcome the independent review and the legislative review of that as well. I personally, in my careers, have reviewed many, many audits for individuals, for organizations, and I want to reiterate that I'm pleased that there was nothing additional found, but also the weaknesses, as they call it, are being addressed in terms of the accounting process, double checks and things like that in that evolution. And so I think I would be surprised if there weren't those type of things. In my experience, you can get page after page after page of ideas. That's why they're independent. And again, we're very pleased with that outcome from the independent auditor. So with that, we'll open it up for questions.
Nate with SDPB.
Hi, Nate.
Lieutenant Governor Michaels, just a quick question here about these audits. You had mentioned that nothing surprising, but you know there was maybe just a few weaknesses that were shown. Is this kind of a good thing that some of these weaknesses are shown because now they can be corrected?
They always are. I think that's the best thing. The governor and I, again, have been through these, and that is an independent source comes in at any time, like any audit. And by the way, the Department of Legislative Audit audits various aspects of state government, municipal, county, schools, and it's just for that purpose, to not only make sure that there are good reporting structures, but what is being told to a board of directors and to the public is accurate. And so I actually am pleased that there are items in there that were addressed. Their term that they use, Nate, is weakness, to correct, but it's like everything. Frankly, I would have been surprised if they wouldn't have found something, because number one, they're that good, and two, in complex situations, you really need to have that expertise to look at it. But nothing surprising. We were pleased.
Any questions on the line?
Lieutenant Governor Tony Mangan at KCCR.
Hi, Tony.
How are you, sir?
Good.
Couple quick questions. Regarding the audit as a follow-up, you know, there had been a lot of talk about about what did the governor or his office know and when did they know it. In your mind, is this another piece of the puzzle to show that the governor was completely forthright with this all along?
Yes, I don't think it's a piece of a puzzle. I think it's just factual. at every stage when the material came out and when the investigation, in fact, the governor asked for the investigation to be done and obviously told everyone. And then when those results came out through the Attorney General's report, it was immediately released. So given the timing of it from when we were sworn into office to when we knew, the information has really been free-flowing. I think what the audit does is now allows a legislative body, our board of directors essentially, to look at the information as it relates to the finances and what transpired there. I don't think you're going to see a whole lot in that audit that relates to the investigation specifically that the Attorney General did. But I think it allays, and it does us. I mean, we're pleased that it found that there weren't any more significant issues.
Regarding a couple issues legislative-wise, the governor was talking last week about one of the issues I asked him was the health care issue for state government employees. There's been some concern that maybe the deductible might be a little too high. And there has been some discussion, perhaps, to deal with that issue in some way, shape, or form. And I know you're involved in a lot of the Department of Human Resources. Are those conversations, Lieutenant Governor, still going on?
Yeah, very good question. Yes, they are going on. In fact, I personally believe that they'll go on up until we adjourn sine die, or before veto day, rather. And the reason is that the economics and the numbers are pretty large. Just to give a little backstory to this, one of the major issues is when health reform laws were passed, they eliminated the caps that insurance companies or insurance plans like the state plans can have. And so it was pretty common, in your employer's situation, Tony, you would look and there would be a plan limit of $1 million. Well, that's a fairly significant amount of dollars. A number of years ago, the state of South Dakota's plan was changed to $2 million. Federal health reform, when it passed a couple of years ago, eliminated that cap. And really, you do see some of those explosions wherein people, when they would meet that cap, would go on a disability or would go on Medicaid. And so it was a way that those expenses could be controlled. And now we have significant, they're called shock, S-H-O-C-K, shock losses, these claims that are one that have increased the costs. And the real nutshell to the answer is all components have to be looked at. What the employee pays, what the employer pays, and how you negotiate the contracts with the actual providers. And so on the employee side, as everyone knows, you keep track of your own insurance. There's the premium that you pay. There's a copay when you see a physician. There are deductibles, and there's coinsurance. And you have to look at that in total, sort of like when you're compensated in your job, you're paid a certain amount, but you also have these other benefits. And that's what folks are getting their arms around is the total exposure that employees have, what the employer has, and how we're controlling costs through healthcare providers and managed care. Did I answer your question?
Yes, sir. And from a standpoint of, in your mind, do you think there can be some sort of a compromise?
I do. Of course, I'm Captain Optimist, but I think that the reason is there's a finite amount of money that we can't keep the public safe. We can't take care of patients at the Human Services Center or Redfield or at our veterans home. We can't, today is Public Safety Day. We can't have Highway Patrol men and women. We can't have the woman who takes care of our custodial needs in our offices. Providing these public services without providing them benefits as well as fair compensation. And that's statewide, obviously.
Any other questions on the line? In the room?
Lieutenant Governor, on a different subject, briefly, a lot of discussion about the texting ban. Going on in different approaches with that, the House supporting a secondary offense and I think most controversially overriding some of the local texting bans. The governor may have weighed in on this himself in recent weeks, but was wondering what, if any, position his you and he have with regards to texting bans, what kind of policy you would like to see or not like to see come out of the legislature.
You know, I'm going to compare an analogy to there are behavioral health bills and those type of discussions, and there's not one of us that knows of somebody that's had a behavioral illness and maybe committed suicide or has had troubles, David. I doubt there's one of us that doesn't know of somebody who has been injured or has texted while they're driving in terms of distraction and hasn't been injured or come close. There's reason to believe that was the cause of the accident north of Yankton. It killed a friend of mine last week. And the hallways of the Capitol involve policy. You write about it. You as the media articulate so people can get involved in their government. When all is said and done, these come down to individual heartbreaking scenarios. The governor has said it, and I'll reiterate the view that he has, which of course I support, is there needs to be a texting ban that he would sign it if it comes down. I do think that the secondary offense issue and the other offenses, discussion that Senator Teason had led last year, I think therein will be the ironing out of it. And if I were going to handicap it, David, I would think that this is going to be with us in a conference committee dialogue. I think that the way that it's been handled in the House and some of the tenor and the approach was masterful to keep it going versus a no, no, no. And I think a very good argument is uniformity. As it relates to the issues of local decision-making and local control, the governor will analyze that when it gets down, but our job is statewide, from a statewide perspective in a ban. I'll reiterate that shows up on his desk, he'll sign it. The bottom line to this is, though, is one of the pieces that all of you have a responsibility and are doing, and we all live in this glass house, but the real practical matter is that second piece, I think, is trying to get out there and notify people that this is just wrong. It's not like you need to have a law that you're not going to put your hand on a hot stove, but for some reason, this has become a scourge that government needs to respond to, and we'll stop it or we'll sensitize to it. And I think that you have all done a good job to heighten, and we have to continue to heighten that. It's just not worth it, it's reiterated in my life last week.
Lieutenant Governor, just to follow up on back to the audit, one of the findings was that, this relates to before the current administration, but related to some of the travel expenses. The previous audits had discussed some of the things that there weren't proper controls.
Right.
But this goes a bit further and finds that in addition to the double billing of receipts that was previously disclosed by the Attorney General, there was nearly $15,000 in translation expenses that were noted to be paid for in cash, in person, on trips, which I guess it seems sort of freewheeling to pick a term. What are your thoughts on the fact that this happened, and is this sort of thing common in the Economic Development Office under the current administration?
It's not common at all, and doesn't even come close to even that phraseology. I think that the uniqueness of the individuals, in review is twofold. One is the way that reimbursement is done, and you'll see in the response, David, in the recommendations, how with the auditor's office, a separate elected official, and the process is in place that shouldn't happen in the future. By the same token, if people have the desire and that ilk, then we've got to find systems in place to be able to control that. But overwhelmingly, like society, there's very little of this that takes place. And the fact of the matter is that overwhelmingly the people who are traveling have a number of checks and balances, in their charges and their receipts when they're out there recruiting. I think the most important thing of that to look at when you're analyzing it and writing about it and when the GOAC hearing is what we have done in the responses and the recommendations to control that. But it's not widespread not common, and it was good they found it.
Do you think that the report says that correction actions have been taken and are being taken to prevent this from happening again? Could this have happened in the past couple of years under the Dugard administration?
No.
Before this happened?
No.
Why do you say why could before these changes were made? Why could this have not happened under the current administration?
I can't understand how it was happening before, but in the way that the new individuals that were in there, the individual travel that was being done, the first of all, the EB-5 program was not part of the office at the time, and that the actual trips that are being taken place overseas, for example, are with the governor. And so that's part of the governor's budget process and our analysis. So that's why I'm confident of that.
The audit also concludes, noting the regards to former Secretary Benda and the fact that he went straight from state employment to private employment involved in something that he had previously overseen, notes that the office should have had a policy in place related to that sort of conflict of interest.
Yeah.
Do you feel that that's a good policy to have, that sort of limiting a state official who's overseeing a project to jump immediately going in and working for that project?
That's a really good question, and I think that that operations and audit will dive into that is my prediction. What's really interesting and was highlighted in the finding, David, as you dive into it, is there are currently state laws, administrative rules, and in our employee handbook, aspects that already cover this, that conflicts of interest, self-dealing need to be disclosed, and that really your fiduciary responsibility is to your employer. And so that was actually pre-existing. What they are saying is that, and recommended in the Governor's Office of Economic Development undertook it, is there should be a specific acknowledgement within the Governor's Office of Economic Development due to their travel and activity that there be even a more detailed disclosure versus just the mandatory one that you as an employee sign on all levels of the state. But I think that in my experiences, having seen these type of things in other environments, that it's always incumbent upon people to realize that we should consistently be talking to individuals in those offices about these conflicts and how that played out. And I think that that will be a pretty significant dialogue on an ongoing basis in operations and audit.
Some people might argue that, well, this sort of limitation is infringing on the freedom of the individual to make a living. And what I'm saying is that you don't agree with that, that you some sort of limitations on hopping from one to the other make sense?
Well, the point is that you should disclose that if there's a potential conflict. And I think that within small states, within organizations, that you will always have a dialogue about that. I mean, we have individuals who are always trying to improve themselves, and so we shouldn't create huge barriers. In contrast with, as a legislator, you can't lobby for a whole year. That's in the Constitution, and you've written about that. So I think the balance really is the communication about it and being able to declare that you have a conflict of interest. And that's why I think highlighting it and continuing to talk about it is very important, and to continue to dialogue and have training and discussion about it. Thanks, Dave.
If I could just ask a question, I'm going to kind of shift gears, I guess, a little bit. I'm just wondering what your stance is on net metering legislation.
You know, in the past, the governor has said will analyze it when it comes to his desk, if it does. If you've never dealt with the topic, it's one of those things. Before I got into the legislature, I had no idea you would, meter a net. I actually had no knowledge of what that was. Obviously, a number of other states do it. I think that the arguments are fairly strong for the producers in terms of how they get electricity. On the flip side, being able to go off-grid, sell back your power is pretty common in other states. So I think it's unique. Our great state is unique, but I think it's unique in terms of the disparity that we see. We don't have a Los Angeles here, and you have a cooperative infrastructure that needs to be paid for. You know all the arguments, Nate. So from that standpoint, I'm sure if it ever came to the governor as being respectful of that branch of government, the legislature, to iron these things out, he would analyze it on a statewide basis and its impact, good or for bad, for the people and especially energy needs to the state.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
You all have a good holiday and safe travels and no texting. Thanks.